Gentlemen, I would like to begin by announcing that Judge Rovner will be participating in the decision of these cases. She's got personal reasons that make it impossible for her to be in the courtroom this morning, but she will listen to the tapes afterwards. She has let Judge Sykes and me know various questions that she would like to have asked on her behalf, and so you should imagine that Judge Rovner is here with us because she, in fact, will be. So we can now proceed with our first case of this morning. Lots of numbers, number 06-1519, et cetera, United States against Smith and many others.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Krista Ralston, and I'm the attorney for Nicholas Acosta in this case. I will be speaking first for just a few minutes here. The basic issues in my case are, there are two basic issues, but they're intertwined, and that is that basically that Judge Crabb in sentencing Nicholas Acosta, I believe, made an error in the guideline calculation and also did not provide sufficient reasons to support her decision on this in her calculations. If I just may go into that a little bit. Nicholas Acosta is the younger brother of Gregorio Acosta Jr., who's one of the other people here, and I want to make sure that we keep that distinct. He was, as Judge Crabb said, very peripherally involved in this conspiracy. In fact, he pled to a superseding information, which was a much smaller conspiracy than the original one. He basically would go to the Lacuna Ray Reservation to visit his brother, Gregorio Jr., and his brother's wife, Spring Acosta, and he did know that they were dealing drugs there, and that when he went to visit them, he acknowledged that he helped with the sale of some drugs, powder cocaine and crack cocaine. Based on that, and the only evidence that was presented in this case having to do with that is that Judge Crabb said she based her decision to hold him accountable for 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine for his participation in selling drugs out of his brother's house during the year 2000. She said in her sentencing basically that based on his activity, she was forced to find that he found that much but gave no real reasons for it. And I had argued in the sentencing and presented some evidence that the only basis for the amounts for that year were a statement made by Spring Lasura Costa to FBI agents in 2004 of her estimate of what the amounts were that were being sold out of their house in the year 2000. And her estimates were that it was 1 to 2 ounces of powder and crack cocaine every 2 to 3 weeks. I've done the math every way I possibly can, and I cannot come up with 1.5 kilograms of cocaine, even in the worst scenario. And if you take it the most conservative way, it would be less than 500 grams. Nevertheless, Judge Crabb held him responsible for over 1.5 kilograms. So that's, and because she didn't give any reasons, I think this court cannot determine whether it's a reasonable sentence, and it needs to be remanded for that. The second very quick issue on that is that she also did not address my argument that in light of her holding him responsible for that large amount, which clearly is more than what's sold out of that house, he should be getting a four-level reduction under 3B1.2 rather than the two-level reduction. And she did not address that issue at all. And I believe that that is also clear error. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ralston. Schmeiser?
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Attorney Sarah Schmeiser. I'm here representing Ernesto Estrada, one of the defendants in this case. The district court at sentencing held Mr. Estrada responsible for 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. The challenge that we have to that finding is whether the facts support 1.5 kilos of crack cocaine. The facts that came out There was one statement that the government brought forth in the pre-sentence investigation, and that was mentioned again at the sentencing, which the defendant challenged by bringing forth other testimony that came out at trial. The district court relied on a single statement from Spring Lasura Acosta that the majority of the cocaine that they transported was formed, meaning crack cocaine. That was a single statement. She testified for a full day at trial. The pre-sentence investigation also relied on statements to the grand jury, and in the investigation she had given many statements to officers. What the district court didn't address was Estrada's objections to the inconsistencies within Spring's testimony and within the testimony then that came forward from other participants. I mean, specifically, Spring testified that she often didn't see the drugs as they were transported, and Estrada was only involved in this from January of 99 through, at most, the end of 1999. Spring testified that when she and Estrada would transport drugs, he would then take them and sell them himself on the reservation between the period of January of 99 and August of 99. It was after August of 99 that she teamed up with Gregorio Acosta Jr., and they started moving towards selling crack rather than powder as they had before. She also stated that she never saw Estrada with crack until later in 1999. All of these statements corroborate the statements of other witnesses that testified about Estrada that testified only about powder cocaine. There was the women that Estrada lived with at various times. They testified about seeing him with drugs, seeing him package drugs, using drugs with him. All of that was powder cocaine. That was Cindy Potak and Mary Sullivan. Tim Stevens testified that he bought powder cocaine 3 times from Estrada. That was the only time he bought cocaine from Estrada.
But, you know, there is evidence in the record, as you were saying, from Spring's testimony, that he was involved with these 2 trips to Milwaukee a week for about the first 8 months of 1999. If you do the math there, you wind up with way more than 1.5 kilos of crack.
Well, the problem is that wasn't crack cocaine. I mean, my argument is that there's absolutely no evidence that there was any crack coming in at that during that period of time.
Aside from Spring saying it was mostly crack.
But she doesn't say it specifically having to do with that period of time. She testified that they started bringing the cocaine in January of 99, and she testified for the, you know, over time periods for the next 6 to 8 years after that, you know, continuing basically until she and others were arrested on the reservation. So her testimony, I mean, we tried to break it down very carefully during trial about different time periods, but she took one statement was taken that said it was mostly formed cocaine, and she did say that after they started bringing in more with Gregorio Acosta and others coming up, that it did then become more, I mean, of the formed cocaine after that. And there was some testimony about sometimes they brought in powder and then sometimes they would cook it into crack on the reservation. But when she was talking specifically about January to August of 99, she said most of the time she didn't see anything. When she did see something, she would estimate what it was, and that there was some testimony about crack. There was one witness that said that they bought crack from Estrada that was $250 rocks. So we're not arguing that there was absolutely no crack involved. We're saying that the amounts, you can't just say, well, they were bringing up a lot of cocaine. Let's just say half of it is crack. That's not fact-finding. Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Birdsall?
May it please the Court. My name is John Birdsall. I represent George Barragan in this appeal. And since we have such limited time, I'm just going to skip a lot of the preliminaries in terms of the exact sentence and things of that sort. And just explain to the Court that our objection to this sentence is severalfold. The Court, Judge Crabb, erred in her calculation in several respects.
You're speaking of relevant conduct at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
She accepted, virtually unscathed in toto, the government's presentation about what the calculation should be. And most egregiously, and I think to the great detriment of all of our clients was the lumping together of crack and powder. This court, upon review of the record, I think this is a very fair statement to say that the testimony from virtually all the witnesses lumps those two together almost monolithically. And it's my contention that not only is that an error that this court needs to correct, but it's also something that perhaps should be addressed in terms of a rule. I realize this court has held that you're supposed to specify what kinds and amounts of drugs, but that was not done here. Yes, the judge said, okay, it's 1.5 kilograms of crack, but what that does is that ignores the constant testimony regarding the lumping together of the powder and the crack.
Now, it was my impression, though, that some of it was coming in as powder and then getting cooked up into crack once it got to the reservation. So that's still dealing in crack, ultimately.
Well, there is some discussion about that. But who does the cooking is one issue. And also as to who is bringing it and whether or not Mr. Barragan in particular is involved. Now, the court used in this sentence four time frames presented by the government, and each one of those has unique problems. The first one was August of 2000 to November of 2000, where they say he was responsible for 170.1 grams of crack. And this is based exclusively on Jackie Martinson, his girlfriend, her testimony, where she specifically says that she never saw anything. She just kind of, quote, knew it was there, end quote. She can't cite amounts. She can't cite kinds. And she can't and she has no personal knowledge of these trips that they took, that there was any drugs at all. The second time frame is from January of 2000 to January of 2001, where they say he was responsible for 963.9. This is the court's findings, by the way. That is based on Spring LeSueur's discussions about her trips with her husband. No evidence whatsoever that Mr. Barragan is involved in those, presented at trial or at sentencing, for that matter.
But he doesn't have to be on the trip. I mean, if he's part of the conspiracy, right?
And there was no, but there was no connection. You're right. That's true. And but there was no connection whatsoever between. And the most you could say about Ms. About Spring's testimony is that, or the allegation they were selling out of her house is that he was seen there. But nobody ever saw any dealing, or there's no, absolutely no evidence about that.
If you want to save your rebuttal minute, it's really up to you. You can save it or use it now.
I think I'm gonna. There is an important point I want to make here. In January of jumping ahead, I'm going to skip one of the time periods. January of 2002 to May of 2002. That's the biggest. Amount, 1,134 grams. This is based exclusively on Ms. Martinson saying he gave us a referral name, and by us, I mean Jackie and Becky Corbine, and we went and ran with it. And it's my contention that this is, he's in jail, he's in prison, and that this court should adopt what three other circuits have done, the Third, the D.C. Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit, that will make, a defendant will not be responsible, or at least not automatically responsible, for the actions, the crimes of third parties, where he's not in a position to assist or enable them in any way. And I guess my time's up. Many other issues.
I know there are, but you have filed a brief, of course, so thank you very much. All right, Mr. Schnacki, is that how you pronounce it?
Good morning. My name is Michael Schnacki. I represent Florentino Castillo. And of course, in our brief and yet again today, I per the order of the court, have been moving to adopt the arguments of co-defendants here, and specifically, as Mr. Burstow alluded, as to the lumping together of cocaine, powder, and crack is a significant issue. But there are particular issues as to Mr. Castillo. He was somebody that was seen on a few occasions early on in the reports of activity at LCO, and that's how I characterize it, because the government's case for the initial allegations of relevant conduct and even the basis for the finding participation in the conspiracy rely on a very weak foundation, a foundation basically of sand, and sand that is shifting, being primarily the testimony of Spring LeSueur, also known as Spring Acosta. One very important thing that was at the end of the sentencing for Mr. Castillo, the government acknowledged that Mr. Castillo did not attend the meetings and was not directing the LCO operation, which was really what was the indictment and was the government's primary theory. They acknowledged he did not attend the meetings. He did not take part in that. And that is significant because Spring LeSueur was the only witness who alleged that Mr. Castillo, along with other people who were later admitted not to have been at the meetings, had been at those meetings. So there's a contradiction there. There's a credibility issue there. And again, the first part of what the government talks about is putting the weight on for Mr. Castillo for the activities of Mr. Estrada and others at a point in time that perhaps I can say Mr. Castillo was on the Indian reservation. As we pointed out in our argument at trial and in our cross-examination of witnesses, this was a resort area. The government conceded there were thousands of people would come every week to that area to gamble, to do the recreational sorts of things. He was seen at parties, again, just as with a number of the others, that were not hand-to-hand transactions that were witnessed. In the government's brief as to their statement of facts, what they seem to rely upon as to a specific thing is then somebody by the name of Robin Mustache saying, well, there was one time at a house where Mr. Zamora was, I saw somebody who somebody else referred to as, quote, boy. And there was some testimony that that name was used, but it is just common sense. Boy, your mother's going to give you in trouble. Boy, that was a close one, what have you. And Robin Mustache, most specifically, as we pointed out, but I just really want to highlight, did not identify Mr. Castillo in the courtroom as the person who was boy. Thereafter, the difficulties, that, and we do contend that it went to the sufficiency of the evidence for the conviction, for the hookup of the conspiracy, and you have to put him into the conspiracy and identify when he's in the conspiracy to determine what is the relevant weight. Then we get to the business between Jackie Martinson, Becky Corbine. They have contradictory testimony as to what their dealings were with Mr. Castillo, not at LCO. Ms. Martinson specifically said they were arm's length transactions in Milwaukee, no conditions as to where the coke was going to go. Our contention is that's an arm's length transaction. That's not conspiracy. Then to the extent there are contradictions with Becky Corbine, the court in making their findings, certainly as to sentencing, did not resolve those contradictions. And has been pointed out by the bulk of authority is that when those contradictions are there, if the court is going to adopt one rather than the other line of testimony, they have to determine why. And Candy Rademacher, who was the organizer of the actual activities on LCO, clearly indicated that by the time frame that Martinson and Corbine, specifically that Corbine is saying anything is going on with Mr. Castillo, the Latin King conspiracy is over. There may be individual arm's length transactions going on. And again, I know my time is limited. The allegations specifically that there was some ongoing benefit related to the weapons and what have you, was not involved in drug transactions. We raised that before, that these were commodities and what have you. They were not seen as furtherance. And the time frame I would just say, finally, they talk about into 2003. The pre-sentence report makes it clear that by December of 2002, Mr. Castillo was in custody. He wasn't directing anything. And to say that somebody that he knew at some time continued to have what we would contend to be arm's-length transactions with Ms. Corbine just is not relevant conduct to anything that Mr. Castillo was doing. I think my time is about there, and I will, if there's anything left, I will reserve. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next we have Ms. Moorshead. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to shift the focus away from sentencing to the trial for a few minutes, if I can, and specifically to a very important piece of evidence that the jury never heard, particularly important as it relates to Mr. Zamora, and that is the evidence that during the very investigation that resulted in this case and during the very interviews in which Ms. Acosta and Ms. Rademacher implicated Mr. Zamora and others, they were questioned about an arson that occurred at the Crone residence, and they lied about what they knew. And I think there's been some attempt by the government to characterize that as something other than lying, but I think it's very obvious in the record that that's exactly what happened, and you can't really call it anything else. There was no question.
The main point was that this arson really didn't have anything to do with the conspiracy, and district judges have to have some discretion to place limits on cross-examination. That's, you know, if you think of concentric circles, out too far, and this district court judge made the call that this was out too far, and that it'd be awfully hard for us to say that was an abuse of discretion.
Well, and that's why I wanted to spend just a few minutes talking about why that piece of evidence was so important and why it wasn't, in fact, so far out in the concentric circle illustration. And that is that this case was a case built entirely upon witness credibility. There was absolutely nothing else presented except witness testimony. And most of the witnesses were alleged co-conspirators and people who were involved in drug sales on the reservation.
Spring LeSueur Acosta was impeached rather substantially, I think.
She was. That's true. And actually, I think that supports my point, and I'll try to explain why. Of these 21 witnesses who testified, only three of the 21 had Pedro Zamora selling any drugs in connection with the Latin Kings in any way. And that testimony was actually somewhat at odds with the testimony of some of the other witnesses. There was testimony by Donald Fairbanks, who had recruited Mr. Zamora into the Latin Kings, who said he came to the meetings, but he sat there like a lump. He assumed that he said, I think his exact words were, I had to believe he might have sold some drugs in connection with the gang, but couldn't say that he did. And he had been there at all these meetings and was there with Pedro Zamora, and presumably he would know. There was testimony from Tony Gouget that he sold drugs in connection with the Latin Kings, but he didn't believe Pedro Zamora ever had. And there was testimony from one of the other key witnesses, Becky Corbine, that as far as she knew, Pedro Zamora, and she was supplying Pedro Zamora with cocaine, as far as she knew, he was selling on his own. So the three women, Ms. Rademacher and Ms. Acosta and Ms. Martinson, become very, very important. They are really the center of the case. And two of those lied during the investigation.
Do we really think the jury thought that these were fine, upstanding people? I mean, had your evidence come in, certainly you would have caught them in one more lie. But how much difference does that make?
Well, I think it stood to make a very great difference here, because it is true that we, all of us, cross-examined these witnesses essentially till we were blue about the motives that they had potentially to fabricate. And we made, I think, a fair amount of headway doing that and establishing the inconsistencies among these three witnesses about just what it was Pedro Zamora was doing. There wasn't a great deal of agreement about that. The three of them differed quite a bit about how just exactly he was involved in this conspiracy. And there was all kinds of testimony about how they were pressured, how these agents kept coming back and pressuring them about, you know, don't you want to be with your children, and telling them who it was they were interested in hearing about, and how the three of these women were talking to each other on the phone in between interviews, all of that. Now, the jury forgave these inconsistencies. I mean, obviously, the jury decided to believe them, to credit them anyway. But there was quite a bit of headway made with regard to their credibility. And in this case, there's a great difference between showing that somebody had a motive to possibly fabricate and showing that someone actually did. that while they were talking to law enforcement about these allegations and these people, they actually were willing to implicate someone they knew was innocent in a very serious crime. So I don't think it's far afield at all. I think it was very much at the heart of the matter.
Was there anything linking the arson to the conspiracy, the activities of the conspiracy?
Well, it was obvious, looking at the reports where they were doing this investigation, that their working theory was that that some of this violence that was happening on the reservation was related to this drug conspiracy, and so they were asking about various violent acts as they were asking about the drug conspiracy. So it was all part of the same interviews.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kelly?
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly, and I represent Gregorio Acosta, Jr. in this sentencing appeal. The Court has heard quite a bit from other counsel about problems that the district court had determining drug quantity, and in particular its determination that the defendant should be held responsible for 1.5 kilograms at least of crack as opposed to powder. I'm not going to beat that horse anymore. Instead, I want to focus the few minutes that I have on a different sentencing error that also applies to Mr. Acosta and that is unique to Mr. Acosta's case, and that is the court's decision to deny him credit for accepting responsibility. Mr. Acosta, unlike some of the other defendants on appeal, pled guilty. And typically, a defendant who pleads guilty is given credit for accepting responsibility because that plea is seen as evidence that he is, in fact, accepting responsibility. If, however, the district court determines that the defendant is frivolously contesting relevant conduct or is falsely denying relevant conduct, the court might come to a different conclusion. It might say that the defendant has not accepted responsibility.
So this is essentially, were you his trial counsel as well?
Your Honor, yes.
So when he does contest, or you on his behalf contested various aspects of the PSR, right?
I did. I made what I thought was a legal argument about the government's failure to meet its burden of proof in terms of producing reliable evidence that established this 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. The question, I think the question is twofold. Number one, was that frivolous? And I don't think that it was, because I think that I was on solid ground for all of the reasons that the other counsel have argued about the difficulty in finding 1.5 grams of crack on the factual basis that was before the court. I didn't deny anything, and I made it quite clear we weren't denying relevant conduct. We were simply suggesting that the government's proof wasn't adequate to establish relevant conduct.
In what sense is that a legal argument? The believability
I think
is
any,
factual.
Any argument about burden of proof, I guess,
well,
certainly
you can always
relies
turn
upon the facts, but burden of proof is a legal standard. It's a threshold, and the government either gets there or it doesn't. And I think that an argument that the government didn't get there because the government is required to rely upon reliable evidence and didn't do that in this case is essentially a legal argument. But even if you look at it as some sort of a mixed argument of applying the law to the facts, I don't think it's a frivolous argument, and certainly it's not a denial or a false denial of relevant conduct. But putting
but
that aside,
fine line, because he's admitted in his guilty plea to the government's account of the offense, the essential offense, and now he's backing up and saying, well, actually, I'm not sure whether it's that there was any crack at all or whether it's that it hit the 1.5 kilo mark or what fine line that you want us to draw here.
Well, the argument was that the government didn't establish that that there was 1.5 grams of crack as opposed to powder.
We were certainly
admitting that there was plenty of powder. But beyond that, assuming that the judge, as she obviously did, said, you're wrong, I'm finding that there's 1.5 grams of crack here, the next step is to ask whether my argument should be attributed to Mr. Acosta. And this court has said that in order to attribute an argument made by counsel to the defendant has to at least understand and agree with the argument. And the easiest way for the court to figure out whether that's true, this court said in the Prejust decision, is to ask the defendant. Do you?
In Lister, we said that we weren't establishing an ironclad rule in Purchase, that you always had to have almost like a Rule 11 discussion.
But I don't think that the Lister decision backed away from that fundamental principle that you simply don't automatically attribute what the lawyer says to the defendant. And Purchase is quite firm about that. The Lister case said, well, the judge tried to make this inquiry, tried to talk to the defendant about whether the defendant understood and agreed with counsel's argument, but Mr. Lister was being evasive. Mr. Lister was saying, well, I don't know. Well, I'm not really sure. I'm just relying on my lawyer. Didn't ever answer the question. And the court said, you know, that was enough because that tells us something about this defendant's moral culpability. The court didn't ask any of those questions of Mr. Acosta, didn't even ask Mr. Acosta whether he had read the objections. So I think that distinguishes Lister from this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.